From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, surrogate mothers, sperm donors, and the fetal rights movement, Barbara Katz-Rothman's new book, Recreating Motherhood, maintains that these new developments are encouraging us to see pregnant women as just containers for growing fetuses. Sonic Youth's new record made it onto a lot of rock critics' 10 best lists. Coming up, we meet the band's bassist and singer, Kim Gordon. An unfinished symphony by one of the greatest composers in history has been finished by somebody else, and it's just been recorded for the first time. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays the results. And critic Ken Tucker gets hypnotized by a new home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. New expressions like surrogate mothers, sperm donors, genetic parents, and state-of-the-art babies are a guide to a new social reality, according to my guest Barbara Katz-Rothman. She says that now that we are negotiating the prices for sperm and for the services of pregnant women, we are talking about the commodification of life. She fears that babies are becoming products and pregnant women are becoming unskilled workers on a reproductive assembly line. Barbara Katz-Rothman is a feminist and a sociologist. Her new book, Recreating Motherhood, examines how pregnancy and motherhood are being redefined by recent legal, social, and technological changes. She's also written books about childbirth and the ethical questions surrounding amniocentesis. Rothman is a professor of sociology at Baruch College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. With doctors, lawyers, legislators, and religious leaders all in on the debate over procreative issues, Rothman feels it's important to maintain a feminist perspective.
When you're talking about procreation, it's a much more fundamental issue. The meaning of pregnancy, of having a baby, is fundamentally different from the point of view of women, from a woman-centered view, than it is from a view centered in the needs and interests of men. Babies grow in women's bodies, in our bodies. So it's not just a special interest or a particular political slant that I'm talking about, but a woman-centered perspective of what procreation means.
You say that these are tough issues for feminists and that the old definitions of motherhood were bad, but the new ones are even worse. Would you explain that?
Well, there was a point in, you know, the kind of Leave It to Beaver America image in which what it is to be a mother is a life-engulfing role. I mean, one is a mother, and that's all that one is. And then all the work that one does and all the way that you are in the world is supposed to be understood in terms of that motherhood. So people talked about, oh, it's a good idea to educate women, they'll make better mothers. Or anything that women did was perceived in relationship to our motherhood. In response to that, some of the earlier responses of the current wave of the feminist movement was to sort of, what a lot of people perceived as denigrating motherhood, to say, listen, this is just a piece of our lives. This is only part of what we do. Part of what's happened is a perception of motherhood not as an all-encompassing, engulfing life role, but as the scut work, as sort of a bunch of tasks that need to be done, many of which involve things like dirty diapers, and that one can sort of do those tasks, and that's what mothering is. And so it's almost like we went to the opposite route. Instead of speaking of motherhood as a kind of sacred calling, we've started to talk about motherhood as kind of cheap labor.
I think you're also concerned that with some of the new technologies, women are being seen as just the vessel in which the fetus is housed.
Absolutely. I mean, once you get a perspective, and this is where this difference between a woman-centered and an outside-centered view of pregnancy, from a perspective that women hold, when we are pregnant, the pregnancy is part of us and the fetus is part of us and we are one becoming two. When you take an externalized kind of vision of this and you say, well, you take a man's seed and you put it in a woman's body and a baby grows. And then the baby is perceived as being inherently, essentially there in its genetic component, and the woman is the place. And so pregnancy becomes a time, a place, a spot in which fetuses develop. And our entire cultural shift over the last, it's not really that long, over the last two decades at most, has been to develop this image of the fetus as something that the entire culture is aware of. And when I talk to undergraduates and I say, show me with your hands what a fetus looks like in utero. And they can hold their hands in that distinctive curled shape.
Mm-hmm.
But when they do that, they always put the head up because that's the way they see it. Okay, or sometimes they'll do it lying on its back, curled up. When I ask them, okay, now picture a pregnant woman. Where is that baby in the woman? They have no idea. They don't even perceive the fetus as being in the upside-down position they really are. They have no idea where the woman's body is. It's like the pregnant women have become sort of invisible in the making of the fetus as visible. And so the focus in the new procreative technology is on this fetus, and the woman becomes maybe a barrier, maybe, you know, at worst a barrier, at best a site for fetal development.
My guest is Barbara Katz-Rothman, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, Recreating Motherhood. There isn't much surrogacy yet. There aren't that many, you know, surrogate mother contracts yet. But do you think that the issue surrounding surrogate mothers is important in setting the tone and determining the terms for the current debate over the relationship of mother and fetus, mother and baby?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that two things happen. One is a certain way of thinking made surrogacy a thinkable thought. There's no new technology there. And bear in mind, the technology that they're using is the technology of artificial insemination. It's been done with human beings for over 100 years. It's not new technology. So it had to be a new way of thinking about pregnancy that made that, as I say, a thinkable thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then having created the idea that, yes, that woman is pregnant, but that baby isn't hers, that a woman has a baby in her belly, but she's not the mother. Changes further, it pushes you further along the line in this changing thinking about motherhood. So that first you have the notion that pregnancy is just this place in which precious babies develop. And then you say, well, so why does it need to be any one particular place? Why does it need to be this woman? If this woman can't house a fetus, how about another woman house the fetus? And so the pregnancy is seen not as a relationship, not as a part of the woman's motherhood, a part of her life, but as a housing issue. And once you start thinking that way, you say, well, listen, she should be able to rent out this space in her body like you could rent out the spare back bedroom. And so you begin to push to this notion that people can purchase pregnancy as a service. Like I was saying, motherhood is cheap labor. That you can purchase the service. And since it's only menial physical work anyway, in our society, and specifically women's work, it's pretty low-paid work. Once that concept is there, even if it is only the 500-600 couples involved or whatever we've got now in the country, you start saying, look, if Susan X cannot smoke while she's pregnant because she's carrying a baby under contract, then why should Joan X be able to smoke while she's pregnant? Because after all, that baby isn't just hers. And you start looking at every garden variety, ordinary occurring pregnancy out there as a site for the development of a precious fetus. And so the surrogacy concept, the concept that just because you're pregnant doesn't necessarily mean you are currently the mother to that child, begins to raise questions about any pregnancy. What makes... And I remember sitting and listening to a bunch of lawyers talking about this, and I just thought, like, I felt like Alice in Wonderland at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. A bunch of lawyers were sitting around seriously trying to discuss if there is anything at all special in a pregnant woman's relationship to her fetus that distinguishes her from anybody else's relationship to the fetus. So if I couldn't blow smoke in at a pregnant woman because I'd harm her fetus and could be sued for doing it, well, who says she can smoke? If I couldn't poison her because I'd be doing damage to her fetus, who says she can do something we might think of as poisoning the fetus?
So you think surrogacy also shows the way that society is beginning to value fetuses and babies more than pregnant women and mothers?
More than, and I think what's more profoundly important here is as distinct from.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fetus becomes the issue. And it's very rarely placed as which do we value more, but really as if the woman was kind of irrelevant housing to the essential thing that's happening, which is the growth of the fetus.
In your world, if you could rewrite laws and contracts and so on, there would be no surrogacy.
Yeah, I find the concept is abhorrent. If you want to talk about women selling their babies, then I'm not thrilled with the idea, but I'm ready to discuss it. I'm uncomfortable with it for all the reasons we've always been uncomfortable with baby sales. But the surrogacy concept is a worse one because it says, well, it's not really her baby anyway. So you can say that she's not selling her baby, she's selling her labor, whatever. But you've already developed this schism between the woman and the baby as the baby is part of her body. I mean, at the point that it's physically part of her.
But what if a woman is willing, you know, is glad to enter into that relationship, and to her she thinks it's really worth the money that she's going to get to rent out her body?
Well, then let's talk about the issues of baby sales. Let's talk about this is something that a woman can produce that's highly valued. There are good, strong arguments against it. People have made arguments for and against things like kidney sales, too. You know, what if somebody really, truly wants $10,000, they have two healthy kidneys, people are standing cash in hand ready to buy, why don't we let them buy? And it's an interesting, difficult debate. My own gut feeling is not to commercialize these relationships. But surrogacy needs to be seen the same way. We don't talk about why don't you just rent out your body for the duration of a kidney transplant, and it's not really your body then, it becomes their kidney. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's your kidney, it's in your body. And I'm saying it's her fetus, it's in her body, it's hers.
Would you have an alternate for the surrogate contract?
What do you mean by
an alternate kind of relationship between a pregnant woman and a woman or a man who wants to adopt a child, or you know, or who wants to contract with someone to have a baby that they would
adopt.
Hand over, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think we've already got adoption in place, and I know that we've got a lot of problems in adoption. A lot of things need to be worked out, but not in, almost in the opposite direction, to remove the commercialization or to remove the pressures.
I guess I'd like to know what you think the best kind of contract would be in an adoptive type of relationship.
Well, in an ideal situation, an ideal world, there wouldn't be a whole lot of women who are giving babies up for adoption. I mean, you have to look at where those babies are coming from. They're coming from women who did not have alternatives earlier on in terms of contraception, some of them in terms of abortion, some of them in terms of raising their own children. Adoption is hardly ever anybody's first choice thing to do in the world. What I'd really like to do is have a baby and give it up for adoption is not something you hear very often, which is why surrogacy came up. You know, will you do it for $10,000? And the brokers got around the illegality of that by saying, well, it's not really adoption because whoever sperm it is, that's whose baby it really is. Noel Keene, the guy who brokered the Baby M case, says that that Mary Beth Whitehead gave the baby back to its father. Like, he gave her a sperm, she turned it into a baby and gave it back. But the sperm was the essence all along. The notion of adoption as a woman's last resort is problematic. Introducing money to entice people to enter into that, you know, if you really need $10,000, you'll enter into that, doesn't make it less problematic.
Now, what you're saying about surrogacy also has relevance for the fetal rights issues. And why don't you explain what fetal rights, what the concept of fetal rights is?
Well, starting with the notion that the fetus is another, starting with the notion that that you have among some parts of our society, though it's certainly a minority view, that from the moment of conception there's a person there. And then you start talking about rights, as we all have, you know, rights to vote or whatever. And so you're saying, okay, which are the rights that are relevant to fetuses? Obviously not voting rights and driving rights. And then you start talking about certain essential rights, and they talk about the right to life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one of the paths in of the current anti-abortion movement is to focus on the fetus as a separate being and discuss its rights vis-a-vis the mother. You also find this being used sometimes to coerce women into medical decision-making against their will. We've seen some really horrific forced cesarean section cases where women did not want surgery and were, you know, pretty much handcuffed to tables to have surgery against their will. And the argument that was used is that the fetus has rights, including rights to certain kinds of medical decision-making. Women incarcerated against their will to get certain kinds of medical treatments for their fetuses. Underlying it is a kind of notion that the fetus and the woman are these separate beings. If you substitute another vision that says the woman and the fetus are a unit, there's one person there, and then you start talking about the responsibilities of the rest of the society to help that unit, to help that mother and her baby, you come up with some much more humane alternatives.
Yeah, you said that in a woman-centered model, you wouldn't have separate rights of the fetus and the mother. They'd be seen as one flesh. How does that change the issue if you see the baby is not planted within the mother, but the baby as the flesh of the mother's flesh, part of her?
Well, it changes a lot of issues. It means that your focus is not on getting through or at or to, not seeing the mother as a barrier, as a hindrance to optimal medical care of a fetus or something, but that you perceive a social relationship. You see that human beings inherently, innately come into the world in a social relationship. And you don't work to destroy that relationship or to ignore that relationship, but you work in support of that relationship.
So you think that the fetus should have no separate rights from the pregnant mother, the pregnant woman?
Give me a for instance.
Of when they should have it?
Yeah.
Well, let's use the example that you used of a forced cesarean section. A pregnant woman is dying. She doesn't want to have a C-section. Her husband doesn't want to have her have the C-section. But there's legal intervention that says to save the life of the baby, she has to have that C-section.
Okay, what's real interesting, of course, is the scenario you're describing happened already. And the woman did not want the section. The section was done. The fetus died. The mother died. The fetus died in a couple of hours, the mother in a couple of days. One of the real interesting things that's happened around all of these forced cesarean section cases is that more often than not, the doctors are wrong anyway. Where they said a fetus was in distress, fetus turns out to be just fine. Where they say there was a placenta previa, she'll never birth vaginally. The woman fled the jurisdiction, birthed vaginally. Medicine is not omniscient here, and they don't necessarily know for sure what they're doing. Part of the question is, whose errors do we want to trust? The errors of the individual woman, the errors of the state and medicine combined. The state and medicine combined have had a pretty bad history of errors around procreation. These are the people who brought its various eugenics movements. Individual women have had a much better history of protecting their babies. On the whole, the people who have been most helpful to babies have been mothers. People who actually made sacrifices and done what needed to be done for babies and been right have been more often mothers than anybody else. So just on you know, who knows what they're doing, there's a question of why assume that the doctors necessarily know better when their track record, even when they brought it to the courts, hasn't been that good. There's a wonderful article in the New England Journal of Medicine demonstrating exactly that, that when they forced these sections, they were very often wrong. So that's one issue. The other issue is that lots of us make decisions that are not necessarily the best for everybody else on the planet. If you have a 3-year-old child and you decide to do some, say, cosmetic surgery, and it's somewhat risky, but you decide you really want this fat suctioned off your thighs or whatever it is people do, you're taking a risk of dying in surgery and leaving a motherless 3-year-old, which is a pretty evil thing to do, all things considered. But we say, listen, the state has no right to step in there and say, you can't do this because of the risks to a child. If somebody wants to become a test pilot and they have kids, they have a right to do that. Pregnancy is not different in that sense, okay? It's a social relationship. Things that we do with our own bodies do affect other people. Parenting invariably does that throughout the life course of parenting. Making pregnant women a separate category of legal being, you know, everybody has certain rights except for pregnant women, is incredibly dangerous route to go.
I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Barbara Katz-Rothman. We're discussing the subject of her new book, Recreating Motherhood, Ideology and Technology in a Patriarchal Society. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, Barbara Katz-Rothman, is a sociology professor at the City University of New York, and she's written extensively on women, pregnancy, and childbirth from a feminist perspective. Her new book is titled Recreating Motherhood. You were just telling us that you don't think that the fetus should have rights separate from the rights of the pregnant woman. How would that apply in abortion? Do you think that it seems like a very relevant question to the question of abortion?
Sure. Women have abortions usually to get unpregnant. And the issue of the fetus is not the issue that's being focused on. It's the avoiding of creating a baby.
Mm-hmm.
The fetal right end of that wants us to think that a baby is there from the moment of conception or sometime real shortly after, that the baby is the genetic material. When an egg and a sperm join, bingo, you got a baby. What I'm saying is that a pregnancy is a social relationship. The decision to end that relationship is one that comes when a woman gives a baby up for adoption. It's one that comes when a baby is, you do prenatal diagnosis and you find, say, Down syndrome, and a woman decides not to continue the pregnancy. More typically, what women are doing is not ending a relationship, but choosing to avoid one. They're choosing to avoid motherhood. Women don't have abortions because they don't value motherhood. They have abortions because they think motherhood is a terribly important thing. Otherwise, they could just have those babies, and frankly, they could sell them. White women could sell their babies for a lot of money on the, you know, so-called black market for white babies. But women don't do that precisely because they do value motherhood. And so what they're trying to do is avoid motherhood. In a sense, we do that with contraception, too. You know, in January, when a woman is ovulating, if she contracepts, then that's a particular baby that won't be born in September if that baby carried, if that egg, rather, carried the say, gene, dominant gene for brown eyes. That's a brown-eyed September baby that's not going to happen. If conception occurs, if a sperm joins up with that egg, well, you've got a more specific genetic potential that's not going to happen if you abort it. From the perspective of women, I'm not sure that it's all that different to do contraception or to do an early abortion. What you're doing is not entering into a motherhood relationship.
You think that a woman should have the right to abort until she feels that the fetus has quickened, until she feels that the fetus has become a baby inside her, until she feels it move and feels it enter into its own. Is that right?
Well, I'm not talking about rights up to point of quickening. I'm saying that for most women, the point of quickening makes it very, very hard to terminate a pregnancy. And that it's much harder to terminate a pregnancy after you've experienced a baby. That before that point, women can terminate a pregnancy. And it's taken a whole lot of fancy technology to try to convince us that there's a baby in there by showing us pictures of things that are like an inch long and say, look how humanoid that looks, and it's got all its genetic potential, and so on and so forth. But the experience of being a month pregnant is not really a mother-child experience. The experience of feeling a foot jab in your ribs begins to be a much more real social relationship. Women find it very much harder to terminate pregnancies after that point. One of the just strange ironies that's brought to us by this kind of medical technology we're developing is that on the one hand, we use all this fancy technology to say, how can a woman terminate a pregnancy however early? Because look, you've got all this genetic potential and you have this embryo or fetus already in there forming, etc. And on the other hand, we turn around and say to a woman who's very well into a pregnancy, who's felt a baby move, who's started to, you know, knit booties, who's really into the pregnancy, we say to her, well, your baby has some horrible genetic disease, and that's a good reason for terminating the pregnancy, and that would be a therapeutic abortion, that would be a medically acceptable abortion. And interestingly, people then turn around and say to her, aren't you lucky to have the opportunity to terminate the pregnancy at this point? So that woman who's grieving the loss of her baby, we say, well, she's had a medically acceptable therapeutic abortion to get rid of a genetic defect. And she's saying, I lost my baby. My baby died. Another woman is saying, look, I just want to get unpregnant. I don't know how I got into this mess. I was contracepting, and oh, my God, my period is 2 weeks late. I want to get out of this mess. To her, we flash these photographs and say, but there's a baby there. So the technology is being used in fascinating ways to make women's experience of the pregnancy match societal needs.
You said that you think liberal feminism has failed on some of these issues. What do you mean by liberal feminism, and how do you think it's failed?
Well, partly it's the kind of thing we're talking about, a way of thinking of focusing on this equality issue and accepting the definitions that are existent already in the society of personhood as essentially what men are, and then talking about women as comparable to. I'll give you a very specific example. Men have seed and women have seed. Liberal feminism has said men's seed is no more valuable than women's seed. Women and men equally contribute to the growth of a baby, and therefore a baby is half his and half hers. Taken as a response to a patriarchal image which says babies are the children of men out of the bodies of women, or Mrs. John Smith bears John Smith Jr., that liberal feminist standpoint looks like a great leap forward. You know, the baby is just as much hers as his because she too has seed. What I'm saying is, well, wait a minute. Who said seed was so important? The only thing that made it so important was that men had it. What if we go back and say, not babies are half his, half hers, and might just as well have grown in the backyard, but say babies grow in the bodies of women. That's a very special and unique relationship. That nurturance is the determining relationship. As other people nurture a baby after its birth and through its life, those people too come to have a relationship with that child, and that relationship may be as important, as fundamental, more important than the relationship of the birth mother. But that nurturing relationship is what we'll look at, not where the sperm came from or even where the egg came from.
I think it's fair to say that there's no one feminist stand on the issues that we've been discussing. And that, you know, even in feminist circles, there are different thoughts on surrogate parents, on fetal rights, on issues like that. Does that disturb you? Do you wish that there was unanimity,
or
do you think that that's impossible and just fine?
No, I'm not looking for a party line, you know, that we could have a platform or something on total agreement. On the other hand, I think that we do need to push towards what I really think is best called a woman-centered perspective on this. Like you just use the phrase surrogate parents. That's wonderful gender-free language. What on earth would a surrogate father be? We don't even know. I mean, there's no idea of what that would mean even.
Right.
but you get caught up in it. I've seen it in the literature on adoption. They talk about birth fathers. Now, good God, what is a birth father? Does that make any sense? You need to have a woman-centered understanding of this. And then we start talking about, okay, so what are our policies, kinds of issues that we need to figure out? What are the solutions to the problems that exist? And there you can have the wonderful diverse voices of different women coming from different places with different sets of needs. There are class issues and race issues that are involved in all of this. And sure, there's not going to be a single feminist voice. But what we really need to do, I think, is sort of take back the territory and say pregnancy and childbirth are things that happen in the lives and bodies of women, and our understanding of what they are needs to grow out of the lives of women.
Thank you very much for thinking through some of your thoughts with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Barbara Katz-Rothman, and she's the author of the new book, Recreating Motherhood, Ideology and Technology in a Patriarchal Society. The book has just been published by Norton. She's a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Life Inside the Mafia. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The rock group Sonic Youth has had a cult following for years with their brand of loud, dense, avant-garde rock and roll. But now the group's new album, Daydream Nation, seems to be gaining some mainstream success. Coming up, we meet Sonic Youth vocalist and bass player Kim Gordon. An unfinished symphony by one of the greatest composers in history was completed by somebody else. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz judges the results. And we invite you to look deep into your radio while Ken Tucker reviews a new series of self-hypnosis home videos. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. In Paris today, more than 140 nations pledged to ban the use of chemical weapons. However, the five-day conference ended short of American goals, as NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
This conference began with an American focus on Libya and U.S. charges that a chemical plant in the Libyan desert was built to make chemical weapons. The U.S. failed to generate international support for its claim, but countries here supported a statement that showed concern for the proliferation of chemical weapons. The conference failed to condemn Iraq's poison gas attacks during the Gulf War or agree to tough export controls to restrict sales of chemicals used for making weapons. However, U.S. and Soviet delegates said the momentum of Paris would add urgency to negotiations in Geneva. There, 40 countries are working on a verifiable treaty to ban the production and storage of chemical weapons. In Paris, this is Deborah Amos.
The U.S., Britain, and France vetoed a Security Council resolution this evening that criticized America for shooting down two Libyan MiG fighter planes last week. Canada joined the Allies in voting against the measure. Washington says the two U.S. F-14s acted in self-defense in shooting down the Libyan jets over the Mediterranean last week. Earlier, U.S. diplomats said the United States has canceled plans for Navy fighters to hold aerial maneuvers near Libya next week. A report in the West German news magazine Stern says Cologne authorities have proof that West German firms helped to build a chemical plant in Libya. The U.S. says the unfinished plant is intended for the production of chemical weapons. Deidre Berger has details.
Customs officials in Cologne confirmed today they have opened criminal investigations against the IBI engineering company in Frankfurt. Stern magazine says the Frankfurt office of IBI, owned by Iraqi businessman Izan Barbouti, was set up solely for the purpose of developing the chemical plant in Rabta, Libya. IBI is now in liquidation. Stern magazine says it has seen some of the documents confiscated by authorities from the firm, and the name Imhausen appears frequently. The U.S. State Department says the West German chemical firm Imhausen was one of the main suppliers for the Libyan plant. Up until now, Imhausen has denied any business dealings with Libya. Now, according to a government source quoted by Reuters news agency, Imhausen will have a hard time extricating itself from the matter. A group of West German investigators arrived in Washington today to get further information from U.S. officials on West German involvement in the Libyan plant. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
President Reagan delivers his farewell address to the nation tonight. During his 8 years in office, Mr. Reagan has delivered 42 nationally televised speeches. The final speech keeps a tradition that has been followed by many previous presidents, from George Washington to Jimmy Carter. Among the most memorable farewell addresses was the one delivered by fellow Republican Dwight Eisenhower, who warned against the unwarranted influence by an institution he dubbed the military-industrial complex. The Pentagon has suspended the Teledyne Electronics Corporation from bidding on or receiving any government contracts because of its indictment in a federal probe of defense contract fraud. A Pentagon statement said the suspension will remain in effect indefinitely and that the Defense Department is continuing its review of Teledyne Industries to determine whether further action is necessary. Teledyne is one of the nation's largest defense contractors, with contracts for some $360 million in Pentagon business in 1987. On the 25th anniversary of the report linking smoking with cancer, Surgeon General C. Everett Koop today recommended the federal government regulate tobacco as if it were a drug. Congress has voted against giving the Food and Drug Administration regulatory authority over the tobacco industry. Koop told a news conference that lawmakers didn't have the latest research on tobacco when the decision was made. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a quiz for us today. He wants us to listen to the beginning of a symphony performed by Wynne Morris and the London Symphony Orchestra on a new MCA recording, and then guess the composer. Ready? Let's listen.
Sound familiar? It sounds like Beethoven, doesn't it? In fact, maybe it sounds a little too much like Beethoven, too generic to be really Beethoven. Give up? It's actually the opening of the first recording of Beethoven's 10th symphony. 10th, you ask? Didn't Beethoven write only 9? If he actually wrote 10, then why was 9 such a superstitious stumbling block for later symphony composers? Bruckner died before he finished his 9th symphony. Mahler called his 10th symphonic work the Song of the Earth instead of Symphony No. 10. But Mahler tempted fate and began another symphony, which he called his 10th, then died before completing it. But back to our question. Did Beethoven actually compose a 10th symphony? The answer is no. Recent research, however, has discovered that a letter signed by Beethoven shortly before he died refers to sketches for a new symphony. And sketches for a symphonic work have in fact turned up that may very well be the symphony Beethoven was referring to. These sketches were discovered independently by two musicologists who were not actually looking for them. One of them, Dr. Barry Cooper, was working on a book on Beethoven's creative process. It's Cooper who has worked out his own realization of the first movement of the Beethoven 10th, what he calls a kind of artist's impression that, he says, is probably fairly close to what he, that is, Beethoven, had in mind, and is certainly far closer to the elusive 10th symphony than anything previously heard. More than half of this MCA disc is taken up with Cooper explaining how he filled the blanks in these fragmentary sketches by imitating Beethoven's own methods in other works. Cooper's lecture is informative, if not exactly enthralling. Sometimes I wonder if the whole thing isn't just a Monty Python put on.
Thirdly, how near is the symphony to completion already? If Beethoven had only written the first few notes, it would be absurd to try and complete the rest. But in fact, a close examination of the sketches shows that in the first movement there is enough basic motivic material to complete the whole movement without the invention of any significant new themes or motifs. Fourthly, how accurately can the missing material be guessed? Not very accurately, perhaps. But if one has a sufficient knowledge of his musical style, and in particular his customary composing methods, it should be possible to get fairly close to the sort of movement he had in mind.
The most interesting aspect of the movement itself is its structure. A lyrical slow introduction in E major, followed by a stormy allegro in C minor, and then a recapitulation of the slow section, a shape quite unusual for the opening of a Beethoven symphonic movement. This spun-out phrase is quite attractive, but this all still sounds more like a parody of Beethoven than music of genius with something compelling to say. There are a number of great works that had to be completed or realized by others. The Mahler Tenth, the third act of Berg's Lulu, the last scene of Puccini's Turandot. But I suspect the symphony Beethoven was contemplating after his ninth was in far too early a stage in his elaborate process of revision to be taken as anything close to a final word. MCA has provided a far more valuable service in reissuing wonderful recordings like Pierre Monteux conducting and rehearsing the Beethoven Ninth, Hans Knoppertsbusch conducting a great cast in Fidelio, and the exciting, eccentric Hermann Scherchen conducting four of Beethoven's real symphonies.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and is director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a world premiere recording of Beethoven's 10th Symphony on the MCA label. This is Fresh Air. Sonic Youth's new album, Daydream Nation, showed up on a lot of critics' 1988 10 Best lists, including the one drawn up by Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker. Ken said Sonic Youth is blurring the distinctions between accessible, commercial-sounding hard rock and the most extreme sorts of avant-garde music. In the New York Times, Peter Watrous said Sonic Youth is perhaps the predominant group in the underground circuit, a band whose best live shows shake the dried bones of rock and roll. They use the techniques of the art rock composers, huge walls of specially tuned guitars, noise, manipulated instruments, and incorporate them into song forms. My guest is bassist and singer Kim Gordon, who co-founded Sonic Youth in 1981. Quote you from a piece that you wrote in the Village Voice about a recent tour that the band was on. And I want to quote you. You wrote, "Before picking up a bass, I was just another girl with a fantasy. What would it be like to be right under the pinnacle of energy beneath two guys crossing their guitars, two thunder foxes in the throes of self-love and male bonding?" I really like the way you described that. And I was wondering what the reality was like compared to the fantasy.
The reality, two whining boys. No. You know, sometimes when the show is going the way you want it to, you know, when the sound and everything is really happening on stage, and you know, that's really, I guess, that kind of power that I'm talking about, that, you know, you see sometimes when you go to see your favorite group or you go to see, you know, your favorite male guitarist. It's just, you know, it's just such a high. And, you know, it doesn't happen that often. You know, maybe one out of every 50 gigs. No, one out of every five or six gigs. And but it's something that you feel like everyone on stage is feeling it, and everyone, you know, in the audience is feeling it.
How would you describe the sound of Sonic Youth?
Like a kitten's breath. No, I don't know. At some parts of it, I think, are very uplifting, and other parts are very ugly, and you know, has a lot of texture in it. I don't know. I think of it like real life.
Mm-hmm. In Sonic Youth, you use not only a lot of volume, but I think you use amplifiers in a way, almost like instruments, going for different effects, for feedback, and for different kinds of distortion. Do you get a good mix on stage? Can you hear well what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's very, I think it's, unfortunately, we rely a lot more on a good stage sound than most bands. You know, it definitely makes a difference on how the show is, how we play. It's amazing, you know, from night to night how it can change. It can just be, you know, just from playing on a hollow stage to a, you know, a solid stage. And, you know, one night it can just be really dissonant and really just a drag. Where, you know, although the same songs in different acoustics can sound totally uplifting, you know, and totally different.
You wrote an article for the Village Voice about a recent tour, and you wrote that sometimes the audiences get hostile. You had one person who threw a drumstick at your head, and
yeah, I mean, that was really over a you know, from different tours,
mm-hmm.
in a way. But it's not, you know, it wasn't that I was trying to describe a hostile audience as much as a
hostile individual,
aggressive,
yeah,
you know, and energy that people don't, you know, know what to do with.
Well, what do you do when they have this energy that they don't know what to do with?
I don't know. I think, you know, it probably affects the music. Sometimes it can really get you going when, you know, there's, you know, when it's really dead. But other times it can just really, you know, totally all of a sudden remove you from your concentration and just really, you know, like somebody, it's like somebody to hit you over the head when you're sleeping or something, or it does make you self-conscious all of a sudden.
Do you ever ask yourself if some fans misinterpret your music?
Oh, well, I know they do. I mean, and critics misinterpret words all the time. Like, this is the first record we didn't put a lyric sheet in, and it's really funny to, you know, to read these, like, in-depth analysis over the lyrics and stuff, and then they have the wrong lyrics.
You have two new albums now. One is the Sonic Youth record, and another record is called Ciccone Youth.
Am I saying that? Ciccone Youth.
Ciccone, okay. Is Ciccone Madonna's maiden name?
No, it's French for Sonic Youth. No, it is Madonna's,
it is Madonna's maiden name.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You also do on the Ciccone Youth record one of Madonna's songs. How come you're so fixated on Madonna?
Well, at the time when we first did that song, Into the Groovy, we were really into her and that song. We just thought it was a really good song. And, I mean, no one in New York sort of took her seriously when she first started, and including us. So when Mike Watt asked us if we wanted to sort of share a record of Madonna covers, we said yes. Yeah, so, you know, we just did it. Not really so into Madonna anymore, because she, I think aerobics have ruined her talent.
Would you like for Sonic Youth to have a wider following, a more popular following, and to record for a major label, for one of the big commercial labels?
I mean, I guess we would like to have a wider following. You know, we would like as many people as possible to buy our records.
I guess I'm wondering if you think it's possible to have that kind of commercial success without smoothing out the edges of the band.
Well, I mean, you always lose a certain amount of your cult credibility the longer you stay around. You know, like now we're kind of in limbo, you know, because you're not always going to be, you know, the next new thing. And so you sort of naturally have to, you're almost forced to seek new audiences. But, you know, there are certain things like, MTV won't play our new video, you know. They'll play it on 120 minutes once, but it's not, you know, it's not slick. I mean, it's more, you know, I don't really think that I want us to, it's not that I want us to really succeed and get a bigger audience just for, I mean, this sounds really, like, conceited, but this isn't how I mean it. It's like I want somebody to break through on MTV, you know. I mean, I want, you know, you turn on MTV and they show the same four videos over and over again. And it's almost like you're pushing, it's not like you're even aware that you're pushing for yourself, but you just want, you know, something to change. And you kind of, you know, well, the ball's in our court, you know. It's, you know, it's almost like you feel it's a responsibility or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Kim Gordon plays bass and sings with the group Sonic Youth. Their new record, Daydream Nation, is on Enigma Records. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. What's coming up, Alex?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report tonight on that Paris conference where representatives from 140 countries have been talking about a ban on chemical weapons. This was the last day of the conference, and apparently the delegates have come to an agreement, a major agreement, to ban chemical weapons production and the holding of chemical weapons. It's not clear that this is actually going to translate into a real cessation of chemical weapons, but it appears to be an important step forward. Also, the Surgeon General comes out and says tobacco is a drug and should be eliminated. And we'll have an interview with the new television talk show host, Arsenio Hall.
Thanks, Alex. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In this age of self-improvement, we've probably all battled with some bad habit or struggled to overcome some personality flaw. Critic Ken Tucker has found a series of home videos that claim to be a powerful tool for creating a more perfect you.
A company called Valley of the Sun puts out nothing less than 24 different entries in its video hypnosis series. They offer titles like Stop Smoking Forever, Lose Weight Now, Ultra Monetary Success, and Attracting Love, which is subtitled Drawing Your Soulmate to You. But of all the titles the company could have sent me for review, they selected the one called Incredible Self-Confidence, exactly the one I might have chosen for myself, and thereby, even before I watched it, giving this company a lot of credibility in my book. I must admit that I was a little nervous about trying to hypnotize myself, but the booklet that accompanies the tape says that the creator of the series, Dick Sutphin, uses techniques that generate an eyes-open, dreamy state of consciousness. And since that's pretty much how I walk through life anyway, I figured, what did I have to lose? After all, didn't the box promise me that I would soon be full of self-reliance and self-confidence, independence and determination, and possessed of a very positive self-image? This was no time to be timid. So I popped the tape into the VCR and listened to Dick Sutphin's soothing opening remarks.
The tape you are about to watch is extremely powerful, incorporating visual and verbal hypnosis, plus audio and video subliminal suggestions. Although you will feel relaxed, Most people do not realize they are in an eyes-open, altered state of consciousness when the countdown is complete. You will probably feel as you normally do while watching television.
Now, I gotta interrupt here. This didn't seem to bode well because, probably like you, the way I normally feel when watching television is faintly nauseous. But mindful that what I was getting here was, to again quote from Dick Sutphin's promotional material, the next step in brain-mind technology, I decided to press on. There were, by the way, no people on screen as I watched, just an undulating pattern of blue, a swirling abstract vortex design that sort of reminded me of those spin art things you do at carnivals or the loopy graphics that Roger Corman movies used to use when Peter Fonda took an acid trip. The instructions were coming quickly now.
A quietness of spirit permeates your body and mind, and we are now going to begin to work together to create the reality you desire to live. And I'm going to begin by giving you several positive suggestions which will be communicated to every level of your body and mind. Now, you are open to these suggestions, which you will accept and act upon. You are self-reliant and self-confident. You are filled with independence.
Well, I don't think I was ever actually hypnotized, but then again, how would I know? I do know that after giggling nervously for the first few minutes, I found the tape extremely relaxing. I'd recommend it just as a way to unwind after a tough day. As for the self-confidence stuff, I don't think it really took hold. Other than going out the next day and submitting myself for a Pulitzer Prize and then asking Terry Gross for the big money I really think I'm worth, I haven't noticed anything different. As for new video releases, there's Mr. North, based on a Thornton Wilder novel and directed by Danny Houston, son of John. And there's The Unbearable Lightness of Being, the Philip Kaufman film that recently won the National Society of Film Critics Best Picture Award. I'm incredibly confident that you'll enjoy both of these films.
When Ken Tucker snaps out of it, he'll continue to write about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer and review video and rock for Fresh Air. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Kenan Ivory Wayans talks about his new film, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. It's a send-up of the black exploitation movies of the 70s. Also, pianist Mac Rebenack, the man rock fans know as Dr. John, is back in our weekly performance spot. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, The January Man, starring Kevin Kline. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.